Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. An estimated 700,000 Vietnam War veterans, almost a quarter of the soldiers sent to Vietnam, required some form of psychological treatment afterwards. Many were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, a diagnosis that was only officially recognized in 1980. How did these vets deal with PTSD? Many went back to Vietnam to visit places where they witnessed traumatic events. We'll hear stories of several of them on today's Smart Talk. Joining us on today's program are Vietnam veterans Bob Smoker, Edgar Hardesty, and Charles Lee. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And also joining us is Afghanistan War veteran Aaron Lax, who participates in a program geared toward combat veterans and their families called Reboot Combat Recovery. Mr. Lax, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. There's going to be a lot of stories told on today's program. And, gentlemen, I want to start with your stories from Vietnam in the 1960s and early 1970s. Bob Smoker, let me start with you. Tell me about your time in Vietnam.
I was drafted in 1969 in May, and in October I wound up in Vietnam.
And you were in the Army, correct?
Yes. I had no intention to go into the Army or go into service at all. And I had no intention to go in the 101st Airborne. I had no intention to be infantry. But all those things happened.
How did you get into the 101st Airborne?
I suppose it would be like the luck of the draw.
Was that good luck or bad luck?
Well, actually, I look at it as being good luck. It was a unit that was very well put together, good discipline, and I was in areas where I was not exposed to the social ills of the war, like drugs, prostitution, and crime. I was in the mountains almost all the time. I never had to worry about who was an enemy. If I saw somebody that wasn't us, it was an enemy. We were never around villages. So in that way, I look back and think I was fortunate.
Hmm. So where were you when you say you were in the mountains? Where did you spend your time in Vietnam?
My base camp was Camp Evans, which was just north of the city of Hue. And we operated out towards the Laotian border, the Ayshaw Valley. And we were in the mountains just outside the Ayshaw Valley.
So your experiences in Vietnam, it's hard to put into 2 minutes, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But what did you witness in Vietnam?
Someone said that the life of an infantryman is like 90% boredom and 10% stark terror. And during the months of March to the end of July, that was a time period of terror, a lot of stress, a lot of tension. A lot of firefights, and it heated up to July 1st when things really got intense.
Now, what year is that?
70.
70, 1970, mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So, in what way? How would you describe what you just called intense?
Yeah. My battalion was in charge of a artillery base, making a push towards the Laotian border and the Ho Chi Minh Trail complex. And this was the first step towards that enemy sanctuary. And we built an artillery base there to support the infantry. And one company of infantry would secure the artillery base, and the other four would be out in the mountains looking for the NVA. And the amount of contact with the enemy increased during that period of time. And then on July 2, early in the morning, my company was stationed on top of a mountaintop, and and we were hit. We were overrun. And that began a 23-day siege of the firebase Ripcord.
A siege?
Yeah, yeah. And
how do you describe a siege?
Well, for one thing, investigations and studies since that time have shown that there were no more than 600 Americans on the ground at any one time during that period, yet the enemy strength was continually at full strength, above 12,000 troops. And the situation was such that we weren't being reinforced as quickly as necessary, and so our troop strength continued to drop. Whereas the report is that the NVA troop strength continued at the same
NVA is the North Vietnamese Army. Actually the regulars.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So at 12,000 to 600, I mean, how do you survive that?
If it wasn't for artillery and air support and support from the ships, we wouldn't have survived.
I don't want to, you know, obviously one of the things we're here to do is tell stories, and, you know, don't want to get too graphic or have you talk about things that you don't want to talk about, but I imagine that you saw a lot of things that you'll never forget.
The percentage of combat veterans is very small, and that's a good thing, because things are seen that the people shouldn't see.
Is there any one thing that sticks with you?
In the early morning hours of July 2, 1970, two platoons of my company, along with the company command post, which I was part of, we were stationed on top of a hill, a mountaintop called Hill 902. And intelligence reports were saying that they were expecting a major attack on the firebase itself. We were placed on 902 so that we could observe where enemy fire was coming from, so that we could call in counter battery fire, expecting the attack to come onto Ripcord, but instead it came onto our position. Two platoons plus a CP, about 60 of us, and we were overrun. The NVA broke through the perimeter and was inside, and they would throw satchel charges down into the fighting positions around the perimeter. And at one point, we didn't know where they were. We didn't know that was happening. We didn't know that the fire was coming from inside our perimeter. At one point, I turned around and looked up the hill from my position, and I saw the silhouette of a soldier, a Vietnamese soldier. And it seems like I stopped, and I looked at him forever. And I pulled my rifle up and fired from the hip, and he went down. And I never gave a thought whether he was alive or dead. I just assumed he was dead. And then we gradually regained control of the hill because of the support that we had. Well, not only that, the guys were pretty solid soldiers, and we fought back, and we were able to clear the NVA out of the perimeter and secure it. And then in the morning we were airlifted out. But that, I think, is probably the thing that sticks with me the most, was seeing that soldier behind me. He was only about 10 feet away. Mm.
Charles Lee, I've noticed you've been shaking your head as Bob was telling his story. You also were drafted into the Army. Tell me about your time in Vietnam.
Actually, I enlisted.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Mm-hmm. I was 19 years old.
No, you were. Okay, now I got you mixed up here. I'm sorry.
I was 19 years old. I was in Detroit, getting into trouble, not going anywhere. And I thought, you know, every day I would ride my bike, I'd go by this recruiter's office. And I thought, well, let me see what's going on in the service. Maybe I'll be a hero and people will love me. And hey, I was that naive. And I went in and the guy told me, he said, well, I'll sign you up as a combat engineer and you won't see any fight. Combat engineer, you won't see any fighting. I was like, okay. And of course, that meant nothing because they give you a test and that's when they assign you. Well, I had a very good aptitude. They put me into communications. And I wound up going to Vietnam. And I got married before I went there because I figured if something happened, I wanted my new bride to get all the benefits. So off we go into Vietnam. And I remember flying on, I think it was Pan Am. And I said, they're not going to take this plane into Vietnam. And that's exactly what they did. We landed at Benoit Air Base. I said, you can't set this plane down in a war zone. You know, I was all Bill Paxton. Oh, man. Oh, man. And I was assigned to, I think it's the 5th Division, 2nd Battalion, Nickel Deuce. And those were dusters and quads. Dusters were twin 40-millimeter cannons mounted on an M41 track. They were Navy pom-pom. They were like the Navy pom-pom guns. Quads were four 50-caliber machine guns mounted on a, what was it, deuce track or something like that. And I was basically in the communications. But I went off on an officer one time when a couple of people got killed. He didn't listen to me. So they kind of put me out on the field and on the track. And we were riding up and down Highway 1, and at first it wasn't bad, you know. Every time we go by some trees, I'd grab my M16 and look around, but everything was fine. We went to Tay Nan, and that's when the fun started. Basically, I don't have the face-to-face combat stories, but it was long range. They were lobbing RPGs and mortars in on us, and we would try to return the fire. And I had a good friend named Almond. We went by last names there, and we were really close. One thing about people that are your friends in combat, you're closer than anybody that you ever will meet out here because you know they've got your back. They you can trust them with your life. And when you lose a person like that, it is very traumatic. Yeah. It's something that you just can't get over. And James was out. He took an RPG in the head. He was on another track. They went into Cambodia. He took it in the head, and I took it very hard. You know, and again, I expressed my displeasure to an officer. That didn't go over very well.
You're a discipline problem.
Definitely.
And I say that joking. Like,
no, there's no joke about that. I definitely needed to pick my battles. But, I was 19. What did I know? And another friend of mine, Thompson, we would sit down and we'd talk, we'd have fun. And one day, I was at Song Bay. Song Bay they had a big airstrip at Song Bay, and it was an artillery camp, you know. And one day, the track committee had parked the track on the other side of the airstrip, by the PL, which was where they kept all of the fuel. And his reasoning was that this is a target. I don't want them shooting at where we're sleeping. Problem with that was, when they started lobbing the mortars and rockets in, the airstrip was a target. We had to get to the track to return fire.
On the other side.
Right. And without even thinking, I just ran across the airstrip with this stuff coming in, you know. And I got to the track. I looked around and the other guys were coming, but my buddy was down, you know. He was down. I think he took shrapnel in the chest. And I just lit into the command. You know, well, we did what we needed to do. We got everything going. By the time we got to return the fire, of course, they were gone. They came out of the bush, lobbed some stuff at us, and went about their business. But he didn't make it. And so I had a few words for the commander about parking the track way over there. So, of course, I was transferred to another track. And that was pretty much it. I just, at that point, I shut down emotionally. Nobody was going to get close to me after that, because the message, I had lost two good friends, and I just wasn't going to let anybody else get close to me.
And we're going to talk more about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I want to tell you about some programs that we have coming up. Scams at the holidays and chronic wasting disease in deer. Now, I have to tell you that Smart Talk schedule this week may depend on the impeachment hearings in Washington. So when we are on, we will have some programs coming up. See what's coming up at WITF.org/Smart Talk. Today we're talking about, we have three Vietnam vets who went to Vietnam, came home. We'll talk about that when they came home, but then also returned to Vietnam. And we're also joined by Afghanistan war veteran Aaron Lax, who participates in a program geared toward combat veterans and their families called Reboot Combat Recovery. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Edgar Hardesty, you were in the Air Force, correct?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
But you didn't see everything from the air. Tell me about your time in Vietnam.
Well, in 1966, I was a junior at University of Baltimore, business management, corporate finance, heading for law school. A fellow down the street said, you're on next month's selective service list, so if you want something that you want, you better get busy and find out. So I had always wanted to fly, so I went down and volunteered for the Air Force, because 4 years voluntary beats 2 years drafting, right? So bottom line is, when I went in, I signed up for everything to fly, and with 3 years of college, I thought I had a really good shot at getting what I wanted. Well, the Vietnam War was just cranking up at that point in 66, so they needed weapons people. So I ended up, after basic training, into tech school and trained on B-52s and was assigned to SAC as a weapons and munitions specialist. 3 years in SAC out of Okinawa.
SAC?
Strategic Air Command.
Okay.
B-52s.
Mm-hmm.
Loading weapons. In stateside, it was all thermonukes, but overseas, it was all iron bombs. And I spent very little time in the States. It was 6 months in Guam, 3 months in Okinawa. Time in Thailand, all of it bombing the area that I eventually went back to see when we visited Vietnam last May. Got home from one of those deployments. After my third deployment, I volunteered for NAM. And within 3 weeks, I had a set of orders to go to Da Nang and ended up the weapons and munitions NCO for the squadron of air rescue, 37th Air Rescue out of Da Nang. Our mission was picking up shot down pilots, extricating people that got in trouble. The mission off the record was pulling out deeply inserted teams that couldn't make their LZ. We try and find them, get them out. So we spent an awful lot of time north. Our forward operating base was Quang Tri, which was right in the shadow of the DMZ. We had an aircraft north out off of Haiphong Harbor, out in the Gulf of Tonkin, and one over near Kisan in the air all the time, and a couple birds on the ground, both at Da Nang and at Wei. Again, the mission was rescue.
So I imagine that with rescue and extracting a lot of those troops that couldn't make their landing zones, that you saw a lot of things that no one will. I'm certain that you will never forget.
Yes. Hard to put in words exactly how this went down. I wasn't regular air crew. I was in charge of weapons and munitions for the squadron. So I flew whenever they needed an extra gun or was a especially hairy mission coming up or something of that sort. But bottom line is, we always got what was after. We were the ones delivering people to evac units, to hospitals, to morgues. We were the ones trying to get mercenary teams and special forces, ROC, all different kinds of special ops teams, pulling them out, trying to get them back to safety. And oftentimes they were badly injured, mangled pretty well. And whether you were a medic or had medical training or not, you were put into service immediately. Nothing technical. It was kind of like the medic on board, which was the pararescue guy in the crew. He'd say, hold this, put your finger here, stop that bleeding there, stuff that wound with this rag, et cetera. I'll be right with you. This guy's worse off than that one, et cetera. So the worst one I remember was I had a blood bag under each arm. The IVs were going full bore because this guy's blood pressure was going right through the floor. Trying to find a vein to thread a needle into to get a transfusion going. He's got a depressed skull problem. He's got a sucking chest wound, and I got one hand inside of his what's left of his leg, holding his femoral artery against his femur to keep him from bleeding out. Mm-hmm.
Well, first of all, thank all three of you for your service. That's the first thing. But when you came home, I mean, one of the reasons we have you on the program today is that you all, were you all three diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder?
No.
No. But do you think that, Bob, that, this is Bob Smoker, by the way, do you think that you did suffer from PTSD?
I think I did at the beginning and didn't know it.
Like in what way? Why'd you think you did?
I had a dream repeatedly of that night on 902, and the strange thing is it would take different shapes. One time it was a North Vietnamese soldier running towards me, and no matter how many times I fired at him, he wouldn't go down. Sometimes I'd fire at him and the bullets would bounce off of him, and I had that dream repeatedly. And then there were times I didn't realize it at the time either, that I had an anger problem. I never hurt anybody, myself. I mean, I hurt myself, but never hurt anybody else. And sometimes my outbursts were violent, but I never thought about PTSD.
Were you angry before Vietnam?
I don't think so.
No.
No, I don't think so. I was always quiet.
Yeah, you seem quiet now.
Yeah.
Dr. Hart, Steve, what about you with PTSD?
I didn't know what to call it. I had no idea what was going on. A lot of depression. You'd bounce between anger and tears. No explanation. The dreams would come, especially dreams about mangled kids. They were the tough ones. Ask my wife about this more than me. I put her through an awful lot that first year back. Gradually began to deal with it, and the dreams continued for 13 years, actually, until they dedicated the Vietnam Memorial in D.C. I was teaching at a school in Baltimore at the time, and the headmaster wanted us to come in with our uniforms on if we were vets. And I did, and there was another guy that came, well, I didn't wear my uniform, but this one guy did, and I knew where he served in Vietnam. I knew he had seen no combat, never been fired upon, and he started telling war stories that obviously were lies.
Mm.
I got really upset, kept it all inside, and all of a sudden I started crying, and I couldn't stop. Made a total
this public event?
Yeah, in the middle of a faculty meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't stop. I made a total fool of myself. Got up, and it took 15, 20 minutes to get my act together in another room. You know what I mean? At that point, it just felt like all that garbage, all that poison just began to drain out of me. And it was fall of 82, Veterans Day. From that point on, I could begin to talk about things.
So it took that long?
It wasn't until years later that at the VA in Lebanon, where they actually put a title or a sticker on what I had. I guess I'm a poster boy for the VA for PTSD at this point.
Mm. Charles Lee, what about you? And the way, I do know because I ask you ahead of time, but when you came back from Vietnam, you did not get a very good reception when you entered the States.
No. They had to pull me off of a guy. He was waving a Viet Cong flag.
In the United States.
In the United States. It was like a mini protest. I just went for him. I just went for him. A couple of cops had to pull me off of him. I had my hands around his neck. And they pulled me off of him, and they told me, we understand how you feel, but you can't go around assaulting people. You know, you fought for freedom of expression.
Yeah.
You know, and I was, you know, kind of belligerent, like, express this. My marriage didn't last. I remember asking my wife a couple years ago, had I changed when I got back? About an hour later when she got through telling me how. The second marriage was a total disaster, basically because I didn't open up to them. You know, I didn't let them in. Mm. Nobody got in, not even my own children. We were estranged from each other for years. It's just within the last 15 years that I started to rebuild the relationship with my family and my children, and that's going on. And no, I did not know I had PTSD. I thought I was okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm going up and down the highway, and you talk about road rage. I was the poster boy for road rage. You know, I mean, I'm going in my car, and I must have looked really crazy to people. And I was finally diagnosed in 2012, and they gave me 100%. 100%.
100%.
100% disability.
Disability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they gave me 100%. I went into therapy. I'm still in therapy. I've got the anger. I still feel it, but I know now how to manage it.
Yeah.
I have to manage it.
What were you angry about? I mean, since you've been in therapy, maybe that's been identified. What were you angry about?
Well, I never did. I was never crazy about authority to begin with. But there were some really bad decisions made by officers in Vietnam. Really bad decision from the top all the way down to lieutenants. You got these lieutenants coming out of school, and you know they don't listen to the people who've been in combat, and they send people out there on from the textbook, and they die. And you know some soldiers actually did away with some of these lieutenants, you know, and I just got angry because I felt used. You know, I felt like I was used and not appreciated. And why did my friends have to die? Why did they have to die? Why were we there even? You say we wanted to stop communism, then we turn around and say, okay, you can have it, we're gone. Then what did they die for? What did we fight for? Kennedy said from the very beginning that it's like going into there would be like drinking alcohol. You take one drink and you're going to need another and another and another. Johnson knew we couldn't win. Nixon used it as a political ploy. So, you know, what were we there for? We were used.
You still feel that way today?
Yeah, I do. I do.
What were we going to say?
When I got home, I wasn't aware of what was going on back in this country. That was September 69. The gal I was writing to, who now is my wife, has been for 50 years. She had kind of shielded me from all that. Wrote to my mom and my dad every now and then. When I got home, my mom had no clue that the guy that walked in the door was very different than the one that left 4 years before. She expected, I guess, everything to pick up right where it left off. No, not going to happen. When I got to the airport at LA International, we had three guys and me in a cab coming from Norton Air Force Base. 36 hours before, I'd been on a mission. So we ride in this cab, and it's the middle of the night, and they drop the other guys off at their gates, and I'm the last one, and the whole tarmac is dead empty. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm walking across with my sea bag over my shoulder, heading for a standby flight. And here comes this lovely young lady with the beads and the stringy hair that looked like it needed to have the oil changed in it, you know, that kind of thing. 60s, we're talking. And she walks up and says, you just came back from Vietnam. Well, it's kind of obvious because when you clear the base, you got to have on everything that you're supposed to have because you're now the propaganda tool for the government. I said, yeah. And she spit in my face and called me a baby murderer. Welcome home, Ed. I have to say that I punched her right dead in the mouth. She just sat right down and split her lip. She was wiping her lip, looking at me. And all I could think of was, I'm not even home yet, and I'm going to jail. She got up and walked away, never said a word. That is very vivid in my memory.
That sounds traumatic. I can't say almost it's traumatic. I don't know how you feel, but very traumatic. That goes right along with your whole combat experience.
Yeah. It's hard to resolve these things. It's hard to find a compartment where they fit, because they just won't come together in a sensible way. Most of us, whether we want to admit it or not, are damaged people. We've seen things and done things and been required to be involved in things that human beings ought not do that. It's my utter conviction everyone's made in the image of God. Yet when someone's trying to kill you and you're trying to kill them, that all gets kind of fuzzy. That all gets shoved aside, and it's stay alive and watch your buddy's back and watch your flanks, etc. Everybody's taking care of everybody. All those things become rather gray, and it's not until years later that, you know, if you're a spiritual person, God in your life is a huge lifeline that helps you begin to put things back together. And I don't know about the other guy's experience, but all I can tell you is Jesus healed my heart.
Well, I only heard this for the first time a few years ago when WITF had an event about, you know, Ken Burns had done a series on the Vietnam War, where one Vietnam veteran said to others in the room, "Welcome home."
Yeah.
And I'll say to you three, welcome home.
Thank you.
That means a lot.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. On tomorrow's program, PFAS chemicals in drinking water and end-of-year taxes. Also, visit our website to get an outlook of conversations we're working on. Plus, you can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information at WITF.org/smarttalk. On today's program, we've heard from three Vietnam veterans about their experiences in country in Vietnam and diagnosed or suffering from PTSD afterwards when they got back to the United States. We'll hear more from our Vietnam vets in just a moment. We're also joined by Afghanistan war veteran Aaron Lax, who participates in a program geared toward combat veterans and their families called Reboot Combat Recovery. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Aaron Lax, you were a captain, served in the U.S. Army for 9 years. Now, during that time, you were with the 1st of the 26th Infantry Regiment, Blue Spaders, part of the 1st Infantry Division, deployed with that unit to eastern Afghanistan. But now that you're with the group Reboot Combat Recovery, I want to talk about maybe your time in Afghanistan, but what you've heard from our three Vietnam vets today. What do you think?
I think that we've come to name certain things and certain ideas, and we think that the Vietnam War, like any other wars, is different. And what I found is that there's a lot of similarities, and we just call things different names. I think back then, during your era, it was probably called shell shock or something like that. And nowadays, it's almost a catchphrase now to say PTSD. But there's a separation, just to be clear. There's post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic stress disorder. And as we're getting more clarity on that, I think it's helping veterans. It's helping us get right access to healthcare and medical professionals and counseling and things like that as we come to learn exactly what this is. So I say all that to say, when I hear all that, it's I think that there's a lot of similarities between guys like me at my age and what we've experienced and what they went through in Vietnam.
Thinking back over the eras, World War II was viewed as the just war. It was the great one. It was the one that everyone, you know, here 75 years later that fought in World War II is held up as courageous and as a hero. And many, if not most, of the people who did fight in that war were. But as Aaron just said, there were soldiers, there were service people who experienced the same kind of things that you did. It was just called shell shock at that point, or they had other terms for it. And as I said in the introduction, it wasn't until 1980, 7 years after a peace treaty is signed, 5 years after the United States left Vietnam, that PTSD was actually recognized. Those first few years, it seems like the government was pulled grudgingly to this diagnosis that a lot of the people who served in Vietnam, that they experienced things that had an impact on their lives. From what you're telling me, Aaron, same thing with Afghanistan, same thing with Iraq.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's just realizing the truth about how each individual is designed to respond to trauma. You know, I even think there are similarities between what first responders go through because, you know, you see something traumatic and it immediately gets imprinted in your brain. I'm not a scientific person. I just read books. So what I've read and what I've seen manifest in my life is anytime something traumatic has happened, that thing has lingered in my brain longer than anything else, even a joyful memory. Mm-hmm. You know, that I find that the more negative experiences are the ones that kind of just stick with you over the years. And it's how you deal with that I think can turn into a disorder or a really big problem in your life that you lose control of very quickly.
Well, one of the reasons that it would seem that the government was so slow to recognize this, and probably society as a whole, is that they'd be viewed as weak.
Yeah.
That somehow there was something wrong in admitting that, you know, what you witnessed, the traumatic events you witnessed, that somehow you were weak if that had an impact on you.
Yeah, I think that's probably a generational discussion. I don't know that I'm a subject matter on that, subject matter expert on that. But I will say I do like the direction we're heading as a culture. We're more open to sharing what's hurting us. We're open to talking about, hey, I'm going to therapy and I have a counselor. I do like that about the direction we're heading. I think it's only a good thing. But yeah, you can definitely see a trend over the years just trending in that direction.
Tell me about your organization, Reboot Combat Recovery.
It's not my organization, but I appreciate that.
You said the organization you're involved.
I'm a volunteer. Yes, yeah. I'm a volunteer, and what I do here in Pennsylvania, I'm one of 11 community groups, basically, and we run 12-week workshops, and it's veteran-led. If it's there's two different sides to this. There's a first responder side, then there's a veteran side. In these veteran workshops, they're run primarily by combat veterans. And what we do across those 12 weeks is it's a workshop of unpacking the difficult questions that veterans come home asking, and most of these deal with a soul wound. We believe that if a person is made up of a mind and a body, then we also believe that they're also made up of a soul. And if the mind and the body can be affected by war, then so can the soul. And some of these soul wounds are things that you may have heard before, like false guilt, a loss of identity, things like that. And so the culminating event, and we actually just had this last week, we're wrapping up our 12-week rotation in York County. Tonight we're having a graduation, but last week the participants are given a book and they're writing things in their book, fill in the blank answers, and kind of doing some introspection and journaling. At the end of the 11 weeks, they actually write out their story. We make them write out a story. We ask them to. We don't make them. I can't make anybody do anything. Even in the
I'm
army.
Not sure. Well, you were a captain.
Yeah, but I think as you heard, officers. We got to trust our enlisted folks. So at the end of of the 11 weeks, we ask people to write out their entire story. And sometimes people's first time, it's just bullet points. But that ends up, as they return to that story, as they're writing it out, they're remembering more detail. It's more vivid. And what I've found personally is that the more I detail my story, write it out, and I share it with other people, it really feels like it loses its power over me. It's not as difficult to talk about those things anymore.
Well, we've heard from our three Vietnam vets. What about you? How did the organization help you personally?
I found Reboot Recovery, and you can find them at rebootrecovery.com. In 2012, I met the... back then, the organization was only two groups. It was literally like a church small group that was meeting in somebody's home, and that somebody was Evan Owens. And Evan was a civilian, and he was living in Nashville. And Nashville is really close to Fort Campbell, and
in
Kentucky, Tennessee. It's right on the border. Mm-hmm. He met a lot of veterans and just saw people hurting, and his wife was an occupational specialist or therapist on Fort Campbell, and so she was faced with soldiers that were having to deal with post-traumatic stress and the disorder, and they were asking really weird questions: can a soul die? Can I spiritually die after going to war? And so they wanted to do more, even as civilians and maybe not understanding, but they did research and they partnered with veterans to start this program called Reboot Combat Recovery. And that's where I found them. My wife dragged me to it the first week because I don't have anything wrong in my life, and I just come back from Afghanistan, and my wife knew the truth, and I was trying to suppress that out of pride, out of fear of having to tell somebody else about my feelings, and because that's not a fun topic, and I will say it got worse before it got better. In April 2013, I made a suicide attempt on my life, and thankfully, I was not successful. The two people that are running Reboot now walked me through every single day, were there with me, and it wasn't just like, oh, here's a book, hope you get better. They were literally there for me, driving me, meeting me for lunch every day, or just doing anything they could to get me the healing I needed.
We heard our other three guests' stories of Vietnam. What did you see in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I went to Afghanistan twice. The first time was a 13-month deployment with 126 Infantry, with the 1st Infantry Division. I was a fire support officer attached to in two infantry companies, we were in a very, I'll say, remote part of Afghanistan, eastern Afghanistan. The first location, I was at the base of these very, we'll say, foreboding hilltops, at which insurgents would often fire down rockets onto our outpost. Our outpost was at the bottom of a valley. And I always asked, I was like, this just doesn't make sense. Why are we at the bottom of a valley? But I guess logistically, it was just easier to get supplies to us. I remember the first time we got hit. I remember just ringing in my ears, and I kind of shrank into a corner. I was like, I always thought I was going to be the courageous guy. Like, yeah, let's go, let's do it on the first time. The first time, not so. But I think that's okay. I think people need to know that the first time you get, if you're going into this line of work, the first time you get hit, you may not be as courageous as the next time or the time after that. And that's what happened over the course of a year. I took a Bible with me, and in the back of my Bible, I kept a record of how many times I feel that God spared my life. And by the end of it, it was 46. I had 46 entries into the back, and I used it as a journal, just kind of describing what happened in each event. War became a reality for me 3 months in. One of the guys I worked with, I was a very shrimpy kid back then, and he was trying to bulk me up. And so we had a makeshift gym out of just odds and ends. And he was trying to coach me and teach me how to lift weights and all that stuff. And so he's like, hey, we got to go to the gym, make sure you change. But I was like, yeah, let me go back to the command post real quick. I got to do something. While I'm in the command post, we get attacked, rockets are coming in, and then somebody's coming in. We've got an urgent surgical, and that's the key word for somebody's hurt really bad and needs to be evac'd. And it was the guy I was supposed to go work out with, and he had lost his hand and his leg above the knee. I've never seen that much blood before in my life, and the imagery is still very vivid. The smell is still there. I can smell the burn pit in the background. I can smell the dust in the air and the irony scent of the blood. And so that what I talk about, just memories that kind of imprint in your brain, that's one that just comes to mind. I think for me mentally, I kind of, it was a very stressful time the first 5 months, but then there was a breaking point in June of that year. I got moved to a different outpost with a different rifle company, and this was a rifle company that had just been thrown together at the last minute. We had two platoons of infantry and a platoon of MPs to throw in together, and we'd never trained before, but they put us in a very hostile area. It was one of the most hostile. And I remember it was actually on my birthday, 2 o'clock in the morning. I hear machine guns going off, RPGs coming in, recoilless rifles coming in. And I just laid in bed and like, yep, another day in paradise. And something snapped in me, and I threw open my door. I had to get to my fighting position. And I remember seeing a blur of tracers across the sky, and I just started running. And you know, that wouldn't have been me 6 months ago. I probably would have shrank back into a corner again. I knew I had to go do a job, and I knew I needed to get where I needed to be in order to help the people I was responsible for. And so for me, just those moments of just watching just the growth through combat and how it really started to transform me into, I would say, who I am today, really just kind of, they stick with me. So
we only have a couple minutes left. Yeah. And Aaron, I'm curious, though, when you say that your wife recognized that you were different when you got home, in what way?
I was a very angry person. Angry.
And I'll ask the question I asked others. Angry about what?
I don't know. Yeah. You know, you don't really know. Yeah. You just know, I think for me, your trauma creates this kind of high almost where you're living. You know, I'll walk around today and just kind of, you're just moseying around and, you know, whatever. But like trauma, adrenaline's pumping, you're sharp, you're focused, you're especially being violent, you have to be violent, and so that incites a lot of emotions. But then to come back, you're expected to just come off of that level, and like it's like going 200 miles an hour and now you're going 5. And so I'll say that's probably why I was angry. I was also disconnected. I felt really numb because of that, because it wasn't, there was no chemical dump to like, I wasn't fighting anybody, but I wanted to fight people. And so having to deal with all that, I think, is why I was described as an angry person. Mm.
I wish we had more time. We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank all four of you for being with us today. But Aaron, if someone listening to this program would like to become involved or would maybe like to take advantage of the services, talk to people like you did with Reboot Combat Recovery, what can they do?
First thing, they can either go online to rebootrecovery.com. They can find a list of locations available in Pennsylvania. You can also email me at aaron@rebootrecovery.com. That's probably the best way to get a hold of me.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, thank you very much, all four of you, for your service and for telling your stories today. Would you have been able to do that a few years ago?
No.
No?
Not without yelling.
Not without you. Again, gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us today. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about chemicals in drinking water, also end of year taxes, maybe some strategies that you can use before the end of the year and before the new year begins in 2020. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.